talking to North Koreans today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Former Ambassador Bill Richardson is trying to get an American released by North Korea. He says he knows what motivates the Hermit Kingdom.
They always come out of the dark when they don't feel they're getting attention. You know, with the Iran negotiations, they come out and say, well, you know, what about us?
Plus, a student from Philly heads to Cuba to train as a doctor.
I knew that I always wanted to make a difference in my community, and that's how Cuba really presented it, is that medicine is a tool to make a difference.
And a Cuban dissident says, don't expect President Obama's visit to change much.
In Cuba, even a question can be seen as a criticism or as an act of aggression.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. President Obama heads to Cuba in 3 days. He's hoping his historic visit to Havana will be a turning point for U.S.-Cuba relations, that it will help bring about big changes for the Cuban people, like better jobs and respect for their human rights. Not everyone believes that will happen, and some supporters of the president's opening to Cuba might say that not everything needs changing on the island, like healthcare. Cuba's healthcare system has long been considered an international model. That's one reason Lillian Holloway went there. She got her medical degree in Cuba, tuition free. Now Holloway is an attending physician at the Cook County Jail in Chicago. She says she first became aware of the Cuban healthcare system when she visited the country. Her 5-year-old niece was with her and suddenly needed medical attention.
We were in Havana, and we were in just a regular neighborhood. And when she got sick, she had a fever, and we were worried because, of course, we're in Cuba and we didn't have any health care or any traveler insurance or anything like that. Not that it would have helped then. And there were like 5 doctors that lived in the same apartment complex that we were visiting. And they all came and helped her. And at the end, we were really worried about payment. And they explained to us that they were more concerned about this little girl getting well. They were actually pretty insulted by the idea of payment.
So you experienced their healthcare system directly before studying there, which is pretty interesting. Is it fair to say that without the ability to study medicine in Cuba, you would not have become a doctor?
Oh, absolutely not. I would have never been able to pay for it. I mean, I was struggling to even go to undergrad, you know. Growing up where I grew up, kids don't usually think about becoming doctors. It's just not something that is a possibility. So I knew that I always wanted to make a difference in my community, and I always envisioned that to be as a teacher or a social worker like my mom. And really, medicine kind of came into me as this tool, and that's how Cuba really presented it, is that medicine is a tool to make a difference.
In the Cuban medical school that you attended, what was the focus?
It's very focused on primary care, preventive medicine, holistic medicine, looking at not just the individual, but the family and the community as a unit, very focused on public health. There might be a physician and a nurse to maybe, let's say, a city block, and they know all of the families that are in that city block, and they know all of the risk factors that they might have too. They keep the records of, you know, hey, I have X amount of smokers, so I really need to do a campaign on lung cancer and, you know, smoking cessation. Or, you know, in my block, I have a lot of women that are of reproductive age that may have unintended pregnancies. Like, we need to talk about birth control, or, you know, just they are able to gear their services to the people that they serve.
And doctors in Cuba are pretty much sort of dispersed around cities and towns and rural areas to basically provide medicine to the population.
Right. And in areas, I mean, I did all of my training in Havana, so it's very much like Chicago in the sense of, you know, just big and urban and, you know, just divided up by city blocks. But even in rural areas, the doctor goes out to the patients. They know who they're assigned to and they find them.
Now you're an attending physician at Cook County Jail. Why there?
I had really been focused on the idea of, again, going back to my community. And at the end of my residency, you know, every year we have to present to our program director, you know, who are our patients, who is our panel. So you have X amount of babies and X amount of old people and X amount of women. And I was looking at my panel and I remember being struck by the idea that I don't think I had one African-American male between the ages of 18 and 34. Black men at that age aren't coming in for preventive care, and that's very sad. I was trained to be the advocate for my patients. And if they're not coming to me, I need to go where they are. And unfortunately, that's where they were. It's in the jail.
How are you bringing what you learned in medical school in Cuba back here in the U.S.?
I mean, that's the big part, is to where I want to practice and who I want to work for. And I take very seriously, we got a full scholarship with the commitment to say that you'll go back to a community in need, either yours or another one, to serve. And, you know, obviously the Cuban government has no way to enforce that. But I take it very seriously, and it really influenced where I wanted to even go to residency. I saw a lot of places in Chicago that had both the infrastructure and the need for someone that wanted to serve. And in the United States, it's funny because we have so many resources, but it's not very different from when you look at the rest of the world and you think about, you know, that the poorer countries have greater burdens of disease and of accidents and trauma. And the same thing really happens in the United States. And so just the idea of knowing that people are going to be sicker where they're poor, and that understanding kind of the public health that goes into illness and wellness, that really was a very strong part of medicine in Cuba.
What is your hope for President Obama's trip to Cuba?
You know, I'm already just pretty in awe by all of this, and this by a person that spent 7.5 years on the island. And when I heard the announcement, my jaw pretty much dropped. And so I hope that there are some decisive changes to the blockade and that things will be able to open up a lot more. But I'm pretty happy with even the idea of President Obama getting to see the country, which is now been like a second homeland to me, that took me in, and for no other reason than to have me come back and help my community.
Lillian Holloway is an attending physician at Cook County Jail in Chicago. She received a free medical degree in Cuba. Thanks a lot, Dr. Holloway.
Thank you.
One thing that hasn't changed in Cuba is the government's treatment of dissidents. Cuban artist Tania Bruguera knows that firsthand. She was arrested 3 times last year by Cuban authorities, once after she attempted to stage a public performance in Revolution Square in Havana. So now she spends most of her time in New York. Bruguera will be watching President Obama's trip to Cuba closely. She says the president has 2 options.
One is to use Cuba for his own means to gain some popularity in the U.S. or to actually secure his legacy. And if he does that, it's only a photo op. That would be, I think, a mistake, because Cubans will feel used, and that will actually reinforce all the propaganda we have heard for so long in Cuba against the United States. The other way he can see this is as coming to Cuba not as a president, but as a community organizer who can talk to people's heart, who can actually mobilize people. I think it's very dangerous to talk about freedom in Cuba or democracy or this kind of concept that are extremely abstract for Cubans who don't know what that is, who have not experienced that. I think the best thing he can do is to act as a free man when he talks to Cubans, so people know what that is.
Walk the walk and talk the talk, but don't make any demands.
The visit of Obama could bring some hope back to Cubans. Raul Castro, after the announcement of the reestablishment of the relationship, had made a strong effort to take away any sign of hope people had for bigger changes. So I think Obama's visit can kind of bring a little of that air again, a spirit of change. But I don't think his visit will change anything, because the only way Cuba is going to change is through a sustainable, long-term work of a civic literacy.
When you say Obama should just act like a free man, what do you mean specifically?
Mm-hmm. Cubans are kind of anesthetized with words that actually they think belong to campaigns against Cuba, campaigns by the CIA or American agencies to dethrone the government. And they don't understand that things like human rights, things like freedom of expression are things that belong to them. So I think by an American president using words that are codified in people's subconscious as part of the big effort the government of the United States has made over years to take away the revolution could backlash in a way. So I think.
So what kind of words should he use then?
The way that he talks should be a way by which he's not afraid to say something that will probably not look good for the Cuban government. For example, the Pope is somebody who speaks very blandly everywhere he goes. Then he goes to Cuba and he self-censors. People were extremely disappointed, and all the hope we had for this trip deflated very quickly, and people got into a very depressive mode because, like, even the Pope is self-censoring. So I think Obama should not self-censor his speech and should actually say anything he thinks is appropriate, not to tell the Cubans what to do, but to navigate with us the process of understanding what we want.
Remind our listeners what happened to you last May when you tried to stage a reading and discussion of the origins of totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt in Havana.
I decided that the response to political violence was knowledge and civic literacy. So I decided to take the origins of totalitarianism from Hannah Arendt. I read it out loud with speakers so anybody in the street could hear it. But of course, the government sent a brigade of jackhammers to destroy the street in front of my house. So the sound silenced me. The sounds of the jackhammers silenced me.
Tanya, I know you're creating something called the Institute of Artivism. What is it?
The Institute of Artivism is a hub where we want to create a space where people in Cuba feel free to bring their vision of the country and for us to provide tools with art and activism for those visions to become hopefully a reality.
And is that going on right now, or are you meeting resistance in terms of people's ability to actually create those things?
Actually, we are right now doing a Kickstarter campaign to get the funds for the project. And one of the reasons for doing that is the government always try to discredit projects because the sources of the money they get for the project. So in this case, the Kickstarter is going to be a public vote.
Which is the best way forward in your mind, particularly for artists like yourself?
The best way is when people go to Cuba, don't try to impose their fantasy into Cuban reality and to try to see Cuban reality as it is, as painful as it is.
Cuban authorities confiscated your passport last time you were there. Do you have plans to go back?
I did go back to Cuba in December, and I was detained for 2 hours at the airport. And actually, I was surveyed the whole time. And actually, the people who were fixing my house, which is where the Institute of Hannah Arendt is going to be happening, told me that they were being interrogated by the police and talked to them not to continue helping me. So I think friction is still there, but I think we have to be stronger than that.
Tanya, why is the Cuban government so afraid of a bunch of artists?
I think the Cuban government and the revolution was great at understanding the power of the symbolic, the power of moving people's souls, you know, and that's what we do as artists. We ask questions and we ask each individual audience that question, and that's scary for them.
Tanya Bruguera is a Cuban installation and performance artist. Cuban authorities arrested her 3 times in 2015, but she's now creating something she calls the Institute of Artivism in Havana. She's been speaking to us from New York. Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Here's something to put our dysfunctional politics in perspective.
Bon dia.
That's a heckler disrupting a ceremony today led by Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff. Rousseff is extremely unpopular in Brazil right now. She's facing mounting calls for her impeachment, mostly because of a massive government corruption scandal involving Rousseff's ruling Workers' Party and a giant state-owned oil company. Corruption charges have also been leveled against Rousseff's predecessor, Lula da Silva. So the president allegedly turned her attention to protecting Lula.
Alô.
Alô.
Lula, deixa eu te falar uma coisa.
That's Rousseff and Lula chatting on the phone. The recording was released by a judge who said it proves an illegal conspiracy by Rousseff to give Lula immunity from prosecution by making Lula the president's new chief of staff. Rousseff replied that what's illegal is the wiretap itself, and she went ahead and named Lula her chief of staff.
Seja bem-vindo, ministro Lula.
The president officially welcomed Lula to her cabinet, undeterred by that heckler we heard earlier, and ignoring renewed calls for her impeachment. Some of the loudest calls have come from a group of young activists with a U.S. connection. They've organized several recent protests against the president. Catherine Osborne has that story from Rio de Janeiro.
Fora PT!
Over 200,000 people showed up at a recent protest in Rio calling for President Rousseff's impeachment. One of those protesters was 22-year-old engineering student Pedro Souto. He was riding on top of a sound car with a Brazilian flag draped around his shoulders like a Superman cape. The car also featured a banner for the Free Brazil Movement. It's one of the main groups that's lined up against Rousseff's government. And it was founded by members of another group that's been spreading fast in this country called Estudantes pela Liberdade, Students for Liberty. And by liberty, they mean libertarian. Pedro says he first started reading articles about libertarianism on Facebook, and he liked what he saw there. Cutting government spending, privatizing state companies, and reducing regulation. This is very far from how Brazil is set up right now. Brazil, like many Latin American countries, is a social welfare state with universal health care and many big companies that are partly government-owned. But a pro-market, anti-regulation movement has been growing in the region. Economist Bernardo Santoro is part of that movement in Brazil. He recalls attending a meeting in Rio back in 2012, organized in part by a group called Atlas Network. He says the gathering was all about brainstorming.
To think new ideas how the movement would grow up and bring Estudantes pela Liberdade, Students for Liberty, to Brazil was one of these ideas.
Both Atlas and Students for Liberty are based in the U.S., and both have received funding recently from, among others, the Charles Koch Foundation, the billionaire-backed group known for supporting far-right causes. Students for Liberty Brazil got started with grants from American donors, but now the group is mostly funded from inside Brazil. And it's big. About half of all Students for Liberty members worldwide are Brazilians. They get inspiration and some training from the U.S. They read papers from the U.S. Cato Institute, and they reference politicians like Rand Paul.
The popularization of internet in Brazil helped a lot the cause.
So did a growing discontent in Brazil with an economic recession and massive government corruption scandals. President Rousseff herself has not been charged, but some Students for Liberty members wanted to try and build pressure to get her impeached in favor of a more pro-business president. That's why they formed the Free Brazil Movement and started organizing protest marches against Rousseff and her workers' party. Now, economist Bernardo Santoro is the real coordinator for the Free Brazil Movement.
Without the street demonstrations, the impeachment will not happen, and if eventually happen, the street demonstration were directly responsible for that.
Political scientist Celso Barros agrees, but he's also worried. He says some economic reforms are absolutely necessary to make it easier to do business in Brazil. But he says impeachment might also bring in changes that are harsher than voters would accept through a normal election process.
The right would like to have less labor regulations. They would love unions to be less powerful.
Barros is also critical of the tactics being used by groups like the Free Brazil Movement. He sees an American influence there, too.
They're clearly inspired by the Tea Party and, you know, this, the whole the recent radicalization that you saw at the Republican Party.
What happens next in Brazil, says Barros, nobody knows. Impeachment remains a possibility. But today, President Rousseff vowed to resist. She said the protests against her won't, quote, bring her to her knees. For The World, I'm Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro.
Let's stay in Brazil for our next story. This is the sound of happiness, at least for some folks. It's the sound of a surfer riding a nearly endless wave, not on the ocean, but on the Amazon River. It's from a YouTube video of a Brazilian surfer named Sergino Laos, and he's riding a single huge wave that surges for miles up the Amazon from the Atlantic Ocean this time of year. We spoke with Laos this week. He says this wave is unlike any other.
Surfing the river, it's special because normally in the ocean we can ride waves 20 seconds, 15 seconds, but in the Amazon the wave never ends.
The nearly endless wave is called the pororoca. That's the term in Brazil for a tidal bore. Bores happen when high tides push seawater into narrow spaces like the mouths of rivers in a single tumultuous wave. The Amazon bore happens every month, but it's especially big around the time of the spring equinox, which is coming up on Sunday. It's when Brazil's rainy season coincides with extra high tides.
We have more gravity from the moon and the sun in the earth, so the tides can move with a big difference between the low and the high tide.
The Pararoca wave can reach 15 feet high and run for hundreds of miles inland. Laos once held the world record for surfing one, and he says he went even farther in training.
My unofficial record is 23 kilometers, 1 hour and 10 minutes riding without stop. So it's amazing.
But only, of course, if you really know what you're doing.
It's a huge phenomenon that you need to have a lot of respect of the mother nature to ride this wave.
The boar itself breaks trees and churns up the muddy waters of the Amazon. Then, Lau says, there are the other natural hazards.
It's very scary because we have savage animals like jaguars, piranhas, snake, and the other animals in the jungle.
Laos was one of the first to surf the Pararoca 16 years ago and will be among the Brazilians surfing the boar next week. Since getting hooked on river surfing in the Amazon, Laos has hunted out and surfed tidal boars around the world, including on the Ganges River in India last year. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Here we go again. North Korea has sentenced an American citizen to a lengthy prison sentence, and the U.S. government is pushing Pyongyang to release him immediately. 21-year-old Otto Warmbier is the American who's been sentenced in Pyongyang to 15 years in jail for crimes against the state, all for attempting to steal a propaganda banner. And that sets the stage for some delicate negotiations. Former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson is taking the lead. He's already met North Korean officials at the UN in New York to try to push for Warmbier's release. Governor Richardson, how do you begin to press North Korea to release this student?
Well, the first point you make is that we should separate this humanitarian release of the young American from the bad relationship that the United States and South Korea and China and the rest of the world have with North Korea. That's a very delicate task. And then secondly, you say to them, look, this is going to make you look good in the international community, and you have a terrible image right now. So you have to be very frank with them, but at the same time, recognize that they're going to want something in return. They always use these detainees as bargaining chips.
What do you think they want in return in this case?
In this case, like in other cases, they either want a high profile visit by an American, a former President Carter or Clinton or the head of the CIA like last time to get another prisoner released, or they want humanitarian assistance, or they want to send a message. The problem is we don't know much about this new leader in North Korea. He seems to be uncertain about his own situation in North Korea, his own power. So he's a wild card. We don't know what he's going to ask in return. But this is something the State Department official channels should pursue. I'm involved because the family and Governor Kasich of Ohio, who's his constituent, asked me to get involved.
I wonder, Governor Richardson, if you watched the press conference, as it was called, in which Otto Warmbier apologized. Here's his description of stealing the propaganda banner.
I approached the wall and with two hands, grabbed the slogan at the bottom and removed it from the hangers. It was much bigger and heavier than I had expected. I became very scared, and I realized that I could not take the slogan. Hastily, I put it down, upside down. I snuck out of the staff-only area and ran up to my hotel room.
Warmbier, in this, he says he was pressured by this Friendship Methodist Church in Wyoming, Ohio, to steal the propaganda banner. It was an elaborate scheme. What do you make of all that?
Well, this is a forced confession. The North Koreans, they have a familiar pattern. They apprehend somebody on dubious charges. They don't give them access by the Swedes that represent the United States there, since we have no representation. The good news, if there is any, is that after these 15 years, what has been given to Otto, that now you can start negotiations. It's a familiar pattern, but this was a forced confession. The young man is scared. He's a good kid. He did something not very smart, but he should not get 15 years for this.
One theory is that Otto Warmbier is being used as a scapegoat in response to the tougher new sanctions that went into effect this week against North Korea. Do you agree?
It doesn't help that the relationship between the U.S. and North Korea is not good. There's no question about it. The relationship is the worst it's ever been in a long time with the increased sanctions. But the North Koreans have also provoked this with their nuclear tests, with their missile tests, with their very harsh rhetoric. So this is why it's important to separate a humanitarian gesture in North Korea's part from the bad relationship and lack of dialogue between the United States and North Korea. My hope is that after this kind of statement by the North Koreans that they are sentencing him, that now negotiations can take place that will lead to his release. This has happened with other prisoners that have been detained.
Are you thinking like he'll be out in a couple months or a couple years?
I think it's closer to months. I don't think it'll be years. I think there'll be a negotiation. It depends what the North Koreans think they can get out of. In this case, we don't know. It might be food, humanitarian assistance. It might be another high-level visit. We don't know. 15 years were given to a young man for a college prank. So you never know what they're to do next. And that's why this situation is so unpredictable.
Governor Bill Richardson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Australians are upset with Facebook. The outrage revolves around a photo of two Aboriginal women. They're covered in body paint and performing a traditional ceremony in public. The women also happen to be topless. Facebook says the picture violated its community standards policy. That got me curious about how the policy actually works. PRI's social media editor, Austin Federa, is here to explain it to me. Austin, how does Facebook determine what is okay for eyes to see and what isn't?
So Facebook's got this kind of very rough outline of standards that they try to have everything on their site abide by. So this applies to articles you might post or photos that someone might upload themselves or posts that someone might make. So with this photo, the part of it that Facebook has actually said is the problem is that it shows a complete female nipple. And that's just a hard line for them that if something goes into that, they don't allow it on their site.
So in the case of this Australian photo, did it simply disappear or did somebody report it to Facebook, then Facebook disappears it? How does that actually work?
Yeah, so there's actually very little transparency when it comes to this sort of thing. We have a lot of trouble, people who work with Facebook from either the content provider or just journalists looking in to try and figure out what's going on. Facebook really doesn't tell us why they take something down. They might send a message to the user, but in this case, all that this person got who posted this was something that said, this has violated the community standards guide of Facebook. These decisions are actually made by a huge number of people working in offices all around the world that their entire job is just to look at content that comes into Facebook that someone flags or reports for some reason.
Do the Facebook community standards policy, does it work differently from country to country, or is there a uniform policy?
Yeah, so the policy is supposed to universally apply to every user on Facebook. Of course, that's not quite the way it works in practice. Facebook will actually comply with government requests to take down certain kinds of information that may violate state laws. Some of the very minor versions of this are in Germany. They'll take down posts that are relating to the denial of the Holocaust, because that's actually illegal in Germany. But there are many other countries around the world where they will just remove posts because the government doesn't like them. In the last set of data we have from Facebook, which goes from January to June of 2015, they took down or they blocked 20,000 pieces of content. That's either images or videos or articles. And the biggest offenders in that were India, which made up 3/4 of it, and Turkey, which made up roughly the remainder.
After this mess in Australia, do you think the company will respond differently?
I mean, every time this sort of happens, like the people of us who work in social media, we kind of hope that they'll take a new approach to it. I think what's happening is that their algorithms are starting to learn what people get offended by, what kinds of images, and they're just not showing them to them anymore. And that's its own problem, too, about the freedom of information spread across the world. But there are issues that Facebook just has historically not backed down on, and I don't see any reason to think they're going to necessarily change on this one.
I would think they would be open to being accused of colluding with repressive governments that don't allow certain things. Does that ever happen?
There are certainly people who are upset about that and concerned about it. Google gets accused of the same thing nowadays. They famously pulled out of China and then changed their policy after that. These are business decisions, and I think we just need to keep in mind that these are not nonprofit altruistic organizations. These are places that are looking to get the most users and the most money in the best ways that they can. And there are definitely times when that means bending to the will of governments that we in the United States may not be happy to see them do.
Austin Federa works in social media for PRI.org. Thanks, Austin.
Thank you.
If you want to see the story and the photos that ignited this controversy, you can. We actually have it up on our Facebook page, which you can reach at facebook.com/PRI the world. And while we're not too worried, we can't make any promises about how long they'll stay there. Today, of course, is St. Patrick's Day. For a lot of people outside Ireland, it's mostly a day for green beer and partying. In Ireland, though, this is the first of a two-parter. Later this month, the nation will commemorate the centennial of the Easter Rising of 1916. It was an armed insurrection that paved the way for Irish independence a few years later. Patrick Cox is here in the studio. He's with our podcast about languages, The World in Words. Patrick, I imagine this centennial is pretty significant when it comes to the Irish language.
Well, in a way, the jury is still out on this as to whether the Irish, once they had won independence, whether they were able to do anything about the decline of the language. Because, you know, Irish is this ancient Celtic language, older than English. It had been in decline already for hundreds of years as a result of a bunch of stuff. British rule and discrimination against speakers, then the potato famine, and also encouragement from within the community to drop the language, from the Catholic Church. So after independence, the government made everybody study the language in the schools. My father happened to be one of those students in this newly liberated country, and I asked him how much he learned.
So, Dad, tell me the words that you know in Irish.
I know how to count to nine. Ein, do, three, cahar, cuig, sé, seacht, hoc, né. And then also I remember this little request. On will cadagom dola mark marshe de holly.
What does that mean?
It means, please, miss, may I leave the room.
It's kind of cute, but that is all he remembers.
So have things improved? Are more Irish speaking the language now?
I think things have improved, but only very gradually. You know, the language has been kind of toxic in a number of different ways. It had these old associations with poverty and backwardness. And then later on, it became associated with nationalism and sectarianism, none of which did the language any favors at all. And there are still daily Irish classes in school and still complaints about them. But there's also a small but thriving culture around the Irish language, even as the number of native speakers dwindles. Just to throw out a stat, the most recent census, which was 5 years ago, found 77,000 people using the language on an everyday basis, not counting people who use it in the schools. That's a little less than 2% of the population, but it's a committed 2%.
What about outside Ireland? I mean, everyone loves the Irish. Do they love the language too?
Well, certainly they do here in the United States. There are dozens of colleges and Irish language clubs and what have you scattered all across the country where you can learn Irish. And there are also research projects at universities. And we asked reporter Doug McKnight, he's with public radio station KAZU, we asked him to look into this. He's reporting from a place many thousands of miles from Ireland, and that is Santa Cruz, California.
I'm at the home of Galt Barber. He and his son Connell are getting out their fiddles.
And Mila and Pisa Kilsian?
Yeah,
Hudson Sigmorland Preston.
They're speaking Irish. And here's the thing, they're not from Ireland. In fact, going back two generations, there's nothing even remotely Irish in the Barber family.
I was born in Glendale, California. My father also was born in California. I think his grandfather, though, was born in Wyoming or something like that.
Even so, Barber has made it a point to speak Irish with his children at home.
Hello, it's Misha Connell, and that means, hi, my name's Connell.
Connell is 10.
Nearly 11.
And he can carry on a simple conversation in Irish and can read it as well. Both Connell and his dad were drawn to Irish by the music they play.
When I heard the Irish music and language, I really felt it.
A short drive away at the University of California, Santa Cruz, linguist Jay Paget slips a strange-looking metal frame helmet over his head.
So this thing looks like something from one of the Saw movies. When we whip it out, this is the scariest moment in our research.
The helmet holds an ultrasound camera and has screws that tighten and force the helmet against his face.
It's meant to really make it firm on your head.
Paget is documenting the Irish language by using ultrasound to make videos of the mouth and tongue while a person speaks.
Talking, it's like this amazing orchestration of different things happening in order to produce speech. And so if you want to study that, you have to see it.
One thing they're looking at is what happens when consonants are formed. Irish consonants tend to be pronounced in two ways, a slender sound and a broad sound.
When I say bio, that's a slender B, and when I say bo, that's a broad B. We want to understand what kind of gymnastics they're going through in their mouths in order to maintain this contrast.
The researchers are working with a colleague at the University College Dublin.
Moira Nicholson.
Moira Nicholson.
No, it's challenging for non-Irish speakers here even. At times it takes a little bit of training if there are sounds that you're not used to pronouncing.
Her job is to find Irish speakers for the study. The challenge has been to find speakers with clear diction. The UC Santa Cruz team then brings the ultrasound gear to Ireland to make new recordings.
We want the data that we collect to be usable as kind of a benchmark, really. So how's the language changing?
One of the ways it's changing is young people are using new words and new pronunciations. And for most young people, Irish is at best a second language.
All it takes is one generation of kids who decide that this Irish is not useful to them and the language can be gone.
Jay Pagin and his team head back to Ireland for a final round of ultrasound recordings this summer. For The World, I'm Doug McKnight, Santa Cruz, California.
And we have more on the Irish language, its history, and its current situation. That's in the latest World in Words podcast. You can get it at iTunes or at pri.org/language. With the centennial coming up, we thought we'd play you this tune. It's called For Whiskey, and it's by a band called 1916, named for the year of the Easter Rising. It's the first song on our Irish punk playlist, which many of you helped create. Head over to pri.org to listen and even suggest a tune of your own. This is The World. Here's a fact you're probably hearing a lot these days. When President Obama lands in Cuba on Sunday evening, he'll become the first sitting American president to set foot in Cuba in 88 years. Last one was Calvin Coolidge in 1928. Silent Cal, as he was known, was an old-fashioned New England Puritan and a dedicated enforcer of prohibition. So what was he doing in Havana? The World's one-man history desk, Chris Wolfe, has been digging in. Chris, what was Coolidge doing there?
Well, it was a twofold mission, really. Much like President Obama, he was in an effort to try and reset relations with Cuba. You remember, America had effectively liberated Cuba from Spanish colonial control, 30 years before in the Spanish-American War, but had imposed a kind of neo-colonial relationship running their affairs. And Coolidge was trying to get away from that. He also wanted to reset relations with the whole of the rest of Latin America, and there was the triennial Pan-American Summit was taking place in Havana, and he was going to try and assuage some of the concerns that people had about U.S. going around bullying small countries. He didn't do a very good job because actually just before he left, he ordered a new invasion of Nicaragua, which never goes down very well with Latin Americans. And actually it was Cal's only trip abroad as president. He refused to fly. But none of this is why the trip was memorable for those who were there. The real memories were made by rum.
Rum? What do you mean?
Well, I do like trying to find a good turn of phrase to explain things, but I cannot find better words than those set down by Beverly Smith Jr., who went along with the presidential party as a reporter for the New York Herald Tribune. And 30 years later, he kind of blew the whistle with a 5-page story in the Saturday Evening Post about what happened. The 6-day junket to Cuba, I'm quoting, had in it elements of pageantry, drama, comedy, and farce, of ponderous dignity and unseemly revelry, of silk-hatted diplomacy with a dash of dipsomania. It became in its latter stages a large-scale smuggling operation.
So when did this party get started?
Before they even got to Cuba, there was a presidential train that took like a day and a half to get down from Washington, and they were all bored and tired by the time they got to Key West, where they were going to embark on Navy ships. It was a Saturday night, and the presidential secretary came out and announced to the reporters, just a big gaggle of them, that the president had retired for the night. And that Smith, I was quoting from, recorded that, "With these words, the dignity of the tour began to crack. It was as though mice had been informed that the cat was away." they could see in the distance the bright lights of Key West, the only city in America that openly refused to enforce prohibition. There was no speakeasies. You just went into a bar and ordered a drink. So they hit the town. There was a lot of hard drinking. They find this rather novel pie that was very popular down there. They called it a lime pie, but of course you call it now the key lime pie. So some of the reporters who stumbled back early brought some key lime pies back, stuck them in the beds of the reporters who were still out on the town. So they'd come home at 4 a.m. and climb into a key lime pie and all kinds of shenanigans.
So this is even before they arrive in Havana. What was it like when they finally got there?
Well, they all went on U.S. Navy ships. And so they arrive in Havana Harbor. There's 200,000 people out cheering and waving as he comes ashore. So many people that it took about an hour for the presidential motorcade to get from the dock to the presidential palace, which is only a few blocks away. Cal is so carried away with what the reporters call this Latin enthusiasm that he starts bowing and waving and smiling. And he bows to this, what's described as a bevy of painted ladies and their madam, until he suddenly realizes who they are, hookers, and then kind of cringes into his seat, puts his hat back on, and resumes his normal unflappable appearance.
So was Coolidge involved in anything, or was he kind of just mild-mannered stepping back from this kind of jamboree?
It's pretty much clear that he wasn't involved in any of these shenanigans at all. In fact, there was only one incident where he was exposed to alcohol, which was at the Cuban president's ranch, where a waiter was bringing a tray of daiquiris. The Secretary of State takes one, the next high-ranking official takes one, and they get to Coolidge, and he artfully does like a 360-degree turn, admiring the art in the room, so that the waiter passes him, and he doesn't actually have to say no and cause a diplomatic incident by refusing hospitality. But there are stories in Havana and amongst journalistic circles that he went out on the down low in Havana. But our correspondent, Beverly Smith, explains that this was because one of the other reporters had a passing resemblance to the president, and someone decided it would be a good way to get free drinks by saying, "This is Calvin Coolidge." And they did get a lot of free drinks, and the party went on all night.
So we've got kind of a cast of characters here. What about the smuggling?
Well, what happened was word went round on the final night of the visit that they would not have to clear customs on the way back. Anyone, any of the diplomats, the Washington officials, or even any of the reporters. And they're all buying half-gallon jugs, as many as they can, to stuff into their suitcases. They're buying additional suitcases. Some of them are throwing out their clothes to try and make room. And then they're all really nervous when they get back into port and on the train going back because they realize how many felonies and misdemeanors they're committing. Our guy, Beverly Smith, comes back with six of these half-gallon jugs and has a huge party when he gets back to his wife in New York.
The world's history guy, Chris Wolf. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome, Carol.
Before we sign off, I want to give you a quick preview of what we have coming up tomorrow on The World. Marco Werman will be back in the host chair, but he'll be hosting from station KPBS out in San Diego, California. And he'll be joined by our Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, for an extended look at the western end of the U.S.-Mexico border. We're going to hear what people on both sides of the fence have to say about all the rhetoric about border walls and immigrants this presidential election year. And we'll hear from a couple of U.S. Border Patrol agents who've seen it all, including smugglers who try to get around the fence in Tijuana by sea.
We still get people on the jet skis that try to come across.
Even though you have Border Patrol right here, they're going to still try?
Yeah, and they're doing it at night most of the time, and they think we can't see. And we even had people with the surfboards trying to, they would put their drugs on top of the surfboard and push the surfboard and try to come up north.
We'll also meet deported veterans, immigrants who once served in the U.S. military, but who now wage a very different fight from their base in Tijuana, trying to get back to the U.S. to live legally in the country they fought for.
I love the U.S. I love it. I love the Marine Corps. Gosh, it was a dream job. But I know I went wrong. You know, I was just, I was wrong in committing the criminal acts that I did. I was wrong in doing drugs. I should have got help. But, you know, I can't set time back.
Another story from the border, unexpected connections between the U.S. and Mexico. In Tijuana, there's a culture of reusing the stuff America throws away, like old garage doors that people who live in the barrios use to make walls for their homes. And some middle-class Mexicans import housing materials, too. They bring a whole prefab house in pieces across the border.
So this house was brought from the United States in two parts. In dos partes, this is.
En las noches.
So she's saying that it's really typical at night here to ask the neighbors to get their cars out of the way so that a trailer can come up on the street with a house on the back of it.
That's all coming up tomorrow in a special Global Nation edition of The World from the studios of KPBS in San Diego. So be sure to join us for that. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.